everyone. There's only so much time in the day. That's why we edited this Vermont Edition podcast for brevity. I know you'll thank us.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We're broadcasting this show live at the earlier time of 11 a.m. today because we want to check in with Vermont's senior senator, Patrick Leahy, before he goes into session in the Senate trial of President Donald Trump. Now, the hearings in the Senate start at 1 p.m., but Leahy joins his Democratic colleagues in a meeting prior to the start of each day's session. We thought some of you might have questions for the senator or be interested in what he's doing and who he's talking with when not sitting quietly in the Senate chambers. We only have Senator Leahy for half an hour before he has to go into session to talk with his Democratic colleagues. And in the second half of the show, we'll be talking with Middlebury College political science professor Matthew Dickinson. But let's maximize our time with Senator Leahy and get right to it. Senator, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity. It's a little bit nice to be talking with Vermont, and because there's a lot of other people who want to talk with me down here, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, who's trying to talk to you today, and who are you talking to? Because as we know, there's a lot of sort of ex parte conversations going on about who might say what and advocate for what and witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. So who are you talking to today?
Well, you know, they sometimes refer to the Senate as a club. And because I'm the longest serving one there, I know all the members well. I could see the press wondering when they saw me during a break over on the Republican side of the Senate. And I was talking with a number of senators, Senator Shelby, Senator Romney, Senator McConnell, and a number of others. And they were saying, well, what, were you discussing a witness? No, we also have to get legislation through, and I was discussing that, or just on personal matters. And it, but what has been interesting to me, there have been a number of quiet meetings of both Republicans and Democrats during the breaks. And there's a lot of concern about what we're hearing. Certainly there's a concern about Professor Dershowitz, who has totally changed his position, come full circle, lecturing people on what the law was at the time impeachment was first written into the Constitution, and misstating the law. I don't mind him being an advocate for Donald Trump. He spends time with Trump at Mar-a-Lago and elsewhere. But if he's going to talk about what the law is, state it correctly.
Well, you know, let's, while you're talking about Alan Dershowitz, let's talk about what he said and actually play a little bit of his tape. And Senator, as you are probably not surprised, we've been hearing a lot from Vermonters who have a lot to say about impeachment and a lot of questions about impeachment, including Scott, who says Professor Dershowitz made outlandish and very dangerous claims on the floor of the U.S. Senate regarding the president's immunity from legal constraints. He said that actions taken by the president during an election cannot be impeachable so long as part of the motive is to be elected. Please explain what strong and decisive actions you will take to prevent Professor Dershowitz's claims from becoming legal precedent. And before we get your answer, let's actually hear how Dershowitz framed it.
And if a president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest, that cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
So, Senator Leahy, listener Nancy also asks, do you think Alan Dershowitz's comment yesterday stating that any actions a president makes to improve his reelection prospects are legitimate if he or she believes it's in the national interest has any legal standing?
No, it has no legal standing at all. I don't just say that as a senator. I say it as a former prosecutor. I'm a lawyer, and it was interesting the number of Republican senators who tried to disassociate themselves from Professor Dershowitz's comments. Actually, what he's doing is asking the Senate to discard the checks and balances in the Constitution which would effectively turn whoever the president is into a king, saying if the president felt he had a good reason to do something, even if it was totally illegal, he can do it. The founders of this country did not want that. This is something that when they drafted the Constitution, you go back to the debate with Madison and Hamilton and the others, they were terrified of having a president who could become a king in the same – remember, this is a group of people who are trying to separate themselves from a king, putting their lives on the line to separate themselves from the monarch, the King of England, and they did not want to create a king of America.
So you don't think that there's any standing to this idea that the president can, you know, basically, yes, make a quid pro quo arrangement as long as it's in the public interest, because the public interest is the president's reelection. But this is what the president's lawyers are arguing. And you are operating within a Senate where unless you can get enough votes, you don't even have witnesses coming. So, I mean, it seems like it's sort of a moot point whether or not it's actually valid.
Well, I think it's not quite a moot point. You mentioned the people concerned. I know I talked with my sister Mary in Marshfield. She's been listening to public radio throughout the whole debate, talks with her friends. Others are concerned. People are. There is no question if Mitch McConnell, because he has a Republican majority, if he just wants to arbitrarily ran through a vote that completely exonerates the president in his mind, if he refuses to bring forward witnesses who know what happened, he can do that. But what does that do to the Constitution? What does that do to America? What does that do to checks and balances? I mean, they simply discard them. They're trying to say that the president is free to abuse his office to benefit himself if he says doing so would serve his policies. That makes no sense. I mean, we've already seen what's happened. Under President Trump, laws and constitutional norms, even basic decency, have been bent to the point of breaking one after another. He has this destructive drive to benefit himself. I'd say it's a cynical one. He feels everything is transactional. Nothing is sacred or enduring. His ideology seems to be simply for his self-interest. He has no sense of history. I doubt if he's read a history book. I've been here with eight presidents, Republicans and Democrats. Every one of the previous presidents, both parties, really talked about what was best for America. Obviously, they cared about their political well-being, but ultimately they said what's best for America. With President Trump, it's what's best for him.
We got a note from Lynn who says, is there any consideration among the Democrats to appeal to Chief Justice Roberts regarding witnesses?
The Chief Justice, we've talked about that. It's hard to find a precedent where that could be done. I think the Chief Justice would say that's something that has to be voted on by the Senate. And insofar as Mitch McConnell has a majority of the Senate under his control, if they want to continue the cover-up, they can vote to do that. And we actually need 51 votes for witnesses. The one area where the Chief Justice might come into this would be if it was a 50-50 vote, he could break a tie. The Chief Justice back in the 1800s did that a couple times, but they were on procedural things, whether to adjourn or not. It would be entirely up to him, and we'd have to get to that at least 50-50 vote. If we had 51 votes for witnesses, then we would have them. I think we should have them. If the people from the administration, if there's nothing to hide, why aren't they willing to come forward and testify?
But do you think, I mean, from all that I've been reading, it sounds like witnesses are unlikely at this point. You have the second 8 hours today of questions that senators are allowed to ask. But it sounds like at this point, it's unlikely that we'll see witnesses, including Ambassador Bolton.
I think it is unlikely. I think that would be a bad, bad mistake. I know there are a number of Republicans who would like to see witnesses, but they don't want to be the ones to be the first to vote for that. If you had four Republicans vote to have witnesses, you'd probably have 15 or 20 who would.
Robert's with us from Burlington. Hi, Robert. Go right ahead.
Hi, Senator. Thanks for taking my call. So you might recall in 2017, the Crossfire Hurricane, which was the FBI and the CIA investigating the Trump campaign's contacts with Russian operatives, and the fuss that they made after Trump was elected about that. I guess it was the fuss was in 2017. The operation was done in 2016. Anyway, what if in 2011, if President Obama had extorted or had pressured a foreign leader to make an investigation of Mitt Romney? Is there any doubt that they would be calling for impeachment? Is there any doubt that even the Democrats would be calling for impeachment? Is there any doubt that Obama would have been impeached? Is there any doubt that he would have been removed from office?
Robert, thanks for the call. Senator Leahy?
Well, actually, had President Obama done something like that, there would have been an impeachment trial. And if he had done that, it would have been illegal. And any senator upholding his oath would vote to impeach. And fortunately, that's not the sort of thing Obama would do. He had things he had offers of help that he turned down because he didn't think they'd be appropriate. He showed the same sense that John McCain did. Remember when John McCain was running for president, there'd been all this, part of it funded by Donald Trump, people saying, well, you know, Barack Obama is a Muslim and he was born in Kenya. And somebody at a rally came up and repeated that to McCain. McCain said, no, he's not. He was born here. He's a Christian, not that his religion should make any difference. He's a family man, honest man. It's just that we disagree on policy. That's a kind of courage that I think Barack Obama would show and a lot of Republicans I know would show, but Donald Trump is not showing.
Yeah, I think House Manager Adam Schiff actually posed that same theoretical question on the Senate floor. What would happen if the situation were reversed and it was President Obama who were being tried for similar accusations and offenses? In terms of Republican colleagues, we have a couple of listeners who are wondering what your kind of conversations you're having, what can be done on that score. Paula says, when off the Senate floor, do your Senate Republican colleagues speak openly about having concerns about Donald Trump and the danger he poses to our democracy, as well as to the office of the president? Is there any hope that both parties can work together to hold this man accountable for the sake of the future of preserving democracy and maintaining the balance of power for future presidents? And John says, in this impeachment process, do Republican senators truly believe the president is innocent of the charges, or are they towing the party line out of fear of the repercussions if they don't?
Well, some are towing the party line out of fear of repercussions. Others, I think, are honest in their support of President Trump and feel he did nothing wrong, although that feeling is diminishing as the evidence comes in that there was an illegal quid pro quo, probably why the president's lawyers have come full circle and said, first they claimed the president did not do it, and then they said, well, he maybe did it, but it wasn't impeachable. And now they're saying the president can abuse his office engage in any quid pro quo to help his election. There are a lot of Republicans who privately are very concerned about that. If the president is acquitted, he's already been impeached, but if he's acquitted in this trial, I would hope that these same senators will be a little bit more objective in their legislation. For example, they should talk to Mitch McConnell. McConnell has over 300 bills that have been passed in the House of Representatives, the vast majority with a Republican and Democrat votes, bipartisan bills. He refuses to even bring them up. I don't know why. He's bring them up, vote on them, and the president can either sign them or veto them. But instead, he seems to want to just carry out very specific Trump agendas.
Why would your Republican colleagues, though, if the president is acquitted of the charges in the Senate, why would your Republican colleagues be more likely to talk to Mitch McConnell about legislation? I mean, if there's an acquittal, wouldn't that potentially be seen as, look, we have the ability to move forward with the agenda that the people voted for, that the president supports, and that the majority Republican Senate wants?
Maybe it's my Irish and Italian ancestry. I'm always optimistic, and I would hope that might happen. I don't know if it will, because a lot of them have primaries. They're on edge about that. They're afraid the President Trump will come in and go after him. Certainly, Mitch McConnell, who is way down in his approval rating in his state, doesn't want to do anything to rock the boat with the White House. I'll talk about just one thing: election security. Now, Jim Condos, our Secretary of State, has been the head of the National Secretaries of State. He's testified with his Republican and Democratic colleagues about how we have to have better election security. People like Mitch McConnell are brought kicking and screaming to the table to do that. And in fact, the only way we've been able to get some money for election security is that Senator Shelby, who's chairman of appropriations, I'm vice chairman. We formed a bipartisan bond to get the money through. This should not be a partisan issue. We know that Russia will try to influence the presidential election this year. We know that's happening already. We know that Russia is doing that in other countries. I mean, Russia wants to be influential, even though they're a small country with a small economy. Their military might is nowhere near as great as they talk about it. Their economy is nowhere near as great as they'd like it to be. Where they can have influence is to undermine democracy throughout the world. And they're doing that, and they're trying to do it here in the United States, and we're not doing enough to fight it. That should be both Republicans and Democrats should want to fight any effort on the part of the Russians to influence our elections, should not take the position that at that time Canada Trump so obviously took at a rally, said, Russia, if you're listening, go in and get a hold of the details in these Democratic servers. And within a few hours, that's exactly what Russia tried to do.
Naomi is calling in from Moncton. Naomi, go right ahead.
Hi. I have two concerns. One is disproportionate power of Mitch McConnell, and wondering if there's any way he can be stopped or sanctioned or something. The other question I have is there doesn't seem to be any way of giving feedback if you're just an ordinary citizen other than through your legislator, there should be some way of contacting the Supreme Court, the Senate, you know, and talking about these issues. So those are my two concerns.
Naomi, let me ask you, who is it that you would want to talk to if you say, you know, no other way other than talking to my elected representatives? Isn't that the process that should be effective?
No, I tried to call John Roberts because I wanted to talk about his role in impeachment. And I also have contacted and unsuccessfully and successfully several times Mitch McConnell to talk about the way the procedure for the trial is going and how corrupt a process it is. So those are my two concerns, and talking to my representatives doesn't begin to address those two issues.
Naomi, thanks for your call. Senator Leahy, what would you recommend?
Well, I don't think Chief Justice Roberts is going to take calls from anybody on a political matter. That's not because of who he is, but that's just following the tradition of the Chief Justice. But certainly contacting McConnell's office and others will have an effect. I appreciate all the calls and emails I get from Vermonters. It means a lot to me. I know when Marcel and I are just going to the grocery store at home or coming out of church, and people come up to us and talking to either Marcel or talking to myself, which is usually the same thing, and telling us what they feel, that is very helpful. I would hope that that's happening in other states. Mitch McConnell has made it very clear he wants just to do whatever Donald Trump wants. That is different than any leader of the Senate, Democratic or Republican, in my years here. I can't imagine, for example, one of the best majority leaders we ever had was Howard Baker, Republican from Tennessee. I can't imagine him allowing this. It certainly is not the kind of is not the kind of mentoring I got from Senator Robert Stafford, Mr. Republican from Vermont, when I came there. When McConnell promises the White House he'll have total coordination of this trial with him, that'd be like me saying when I was a prosecutor in Vermont, well, I'm not going to do anything unless it's okayed by the person I'm prosecuting. I think there'd be an immediate uproar, throw that guy out of office. Well, that's what is happening.
Senator Leahy, yesterday during the questions, there was a question, I believe it was from Alaska Senator Murkowski, about what should the burden of proof be? And she asked it of both the president's lawyers and the House managers, but it's really a question that goes to each individual senator as well. What is the burden of proof that you believe you are following as you decide whether or not to convict the president of the charges? You know, is it a burden of proof without a doubt? Is it a reasonable standard of proof? Is it I'm reasonably sure that the president probably did the things he's accused of? I mean, given that it is not laid out explicitly in the same way that it would be for a different kind of trial, what are you operating on as your burden of proof in determining how you vote?
Again, when I was a prosecutor, those were criminal cases. You had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That is not the situation here. Each senator has to make up his or her own mind. Does the material that's come before us, does it justify impeachment? What is troubling on this one, there are no witnesses. You know, in the Clinton trial, there were at least 9 key witnesses, including President Clinton himself, who testified for hundreds of hours under oath. We had all of that. And even then, we deposed three more witnesses during the trial. They asked Senator Mike DeWine, a Republican and former prosecutor from Ohio, to represent the Republicans. They asked me, as a Democrat, a former prosecutor, to represent the Democrats. Everybody, Republican and Democrat alike, agreed that Senator DeWine and I did it in a nonpartisan, professional way. None of that's happening here. They are hiding all the key witnesses. And my reaction is, if you're not guilty, if you're not guilty of something, and if you've got nothing to hide, why are you hiding it? If there is nothing to hide, why do you continue to hide it? Remember, unlike what some of the president's lawyers have said about beyond a reasonable doubt and everything else, they didn't have such things when the we didn't have a federal criminal code when the Constitution was written. They knew impeachment meant abuse of office, high crimes, misdemeanors, basically abuse of office. It is a pretty remarkable abuse of office when you tell a foreign power, if you don't help me get dirt on my potential opponent, then I'm going to hold back hundreds of millions of dollars that have been appropriated to help you fight the Russians. I mean, the irony is they're saying, we're going to let you, if you don't help me, sorry, you're going to face the Russians yourself. I mean, the same Russians that tried to interfere and still try to interfere in our elections.
Senator Leahy.
I would say this to my fellow senators. If you have an acquittal when there are clear facts that have been hidden and ignored, that's hardly an acquittal.
But you, so you're making the case for what you believe to have been proven by the House managers, I believe, and by the House in their process. But what do you believe should be the burden of proof or the burden that each senator should be using to determine how they vote? I mean, are you thinking it should be proven without a reasonable doubt? What is your standard?
That was not the standard when the Constitution was written. Certainly I'd want to have clear and convincing evidence of a crime having been convicted. The GAO report that came out just before the trial started, that was, in my mind, clear and convincing evidence of a crime. The fact that they refused to have John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, who know exactly what happened, the fact that they're covering up their testimony, that, in my mind, gives me evidence of covering up guilt, and that points to guilt.
We have to let you go in a moment so you can go to the caucus meeting that I believe you have.
I'd rather talk with you and my fellow Vermonter.
Well, good. We'll keep you as long as we can. But let me ask you before you go. Yesterday you asked a couple of questions. Do you have questions prepared for today? And are they questions that are designed for an audience, sort of political questions that are rhetorical in nature? Or are there questions that you actually still need answers to?
Well, one will go into this very dangerous argument that the president's lawyers made last night. I mean, if you could have seen me, you would have seen me suddenly sit up upright, grabbing my pen and paper when they made it. They were saying that the president cannot be impeached for any kind of quid pro quo to benefit his reelection as long as he believes that he being president is in the best interest of the country. Oh, come on. That would allow a president to do anything he wanted to do while he's running for election, simply saying, I am the state. I am the most important thing to America, so I can do anything to keep me here. So I'm going to ask questions about that. Where in heaven's name can anybody find anything in constitutional history that would back up such an outrageous, unsubstantiated political claim? I was as a lawyer, I was embarrassed to see the president's lawyers make such an outrageous claim.
And is that something that you'll be discussing in the meeting that you're headed to with your Democratic colleagues?
Yeah, and I intend to bring that. I mean, if I had come up with something that stupid and inane when I was in law school, instead of graduating high in my class, I would have probably flunked out on the spot.
You know, you are the longest serving senator. It seems like that is a question. The question that you pose is one that is likely to be desired to be posed by the majority of your Democratic colleagues. Do you get precedence to say, no, I'm going to be the one who asks that question? I'll add your name onto it as we hand it up to the Chief Justice, but it's my question.
We have some senators who want their names on things. I just want the question to be asked. I'll be happy to ask it. I'll be happy to have anybody's name on it they want, or if somebody else wants to ask it. I just want to make sure it is asked, because we cannot leave the record with such a distorted view of our Constitution, our law, our requirements, that cannot be the precedent for future presidents.
Well, Senator Patrick Leahy, I appreciate you being with us. Perhaps we'll get you back before the trial ends. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
And we're also now going to shift gears and talk about this from a different perspective, from Professor Matthew Dickinson, who's a professor of political science at Middlebury College. And he is with us from the college's recording studio now. Professor Dickinson, thank you for making the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
And we have callers who do have questions for you. Mike is calling in from Colchester. Hey, Mike, go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask Senator Leahy this, but I missed out. But since we've never had an impeachment during a presidential election year, I'm curious of how it's fair that, like, Senator Sanders and Warren and Klobuchar are supposed to sit up there and not be biased and not have any conflict of interest on voting for the impeachment of the sitting president. I've been watching a ton of C-SPAN, and there are, like, a lot of people in the country wondering how this is okay, and it seems pretty unprecedented, so I'm looking for some guidance on this or something. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for your call, and I think Professor Dickinson is really great to answer this, actually. I mean, what about this idea that we have three sitting senators who are also running for president? Can they recuse themselves? Should they recuse themselves?
Well, they've all been asked that. I was at a rally when Amy Klobuchar was asked this, and her response, I think, reflects the sentiment of all three of these senators, which is they feel it's their constitutional duty. They're obligated to sit as jurors, or more properly, judges in a Senate trial. That's not something that they take lightly. And let's be clear here. This isn't necessarily advantaging them in terms of their presidential bid. I mean, they would much rather be in Iowa right now in these next few days, but they're doing their constitutional duties.
I mean, we've also heard from Republican senators. Mitch McConnell in particular comes to mind, who said, oh, no, I'm not impartial in this. So it's not necessarily only candidates running for president who may have a particular bias that they're coming into, or some way that they see a benefit to them in voting one way or another.
Well, listen, the notion of elections is to hold your representative or your senator accountable. And it's just not the presidential race that's important here. We've got a Senate races that are crucial. And you look at somebody like Susan Collins, who's in a very tough reelection race in Maine, and she has to balance partisan interests, her own beliefs about what's right, but also her reelection chances here. So the election imperative cuts many ways here.
Well, while we're talking about this and partisan politics, let's go to Richard, who's with us from Warrensburg, New York. Richard, hi.
Mike, I was hoping to ask this to the senator, but the professor would be fine. On the previous caller's question, it has been pointed out that the impeachment of Johnson back in the 1800s took place in 1868. If that's correct, wouldn't that have been an election year? But my question directly has to do with the issue where they've been quoting congressmen during the Clinton impeachment who are saying, well, the impeachment process should be bipartisan. It should have overwhelming support and not be a partisan issue. Can there be some way to bring up in a finessed language the idea that those persons who are bullied by the president, by his tweets, by his name-calling, by his anti-election campaigning against them, are in fact intimidated to doing what they would normally think is the right thing? Is there some way to show that the Republican response, not being in favor of the impeachment, has something to do other than with the actual facts of the case?
Thanks for the call, Richard. Professor Dickinson, how would you parse that?
It's difficult, obviously, to unpack motives. In fact, that's one of the arguments that the president's defenders are making, that questions of intent have no place in this trial. Having said that, I'm doubtful that the Republican senators' resistance so far, for instance, for calling witnesses and probably voting to convict the president, is driven by fear of what Trump can do to them. I think most of them have partisan reasons rooted in electoral ambitions, but also their own principles, and arguing that even if we don't agree what President Trump did in terms of the telephone call and withholding aid, we really don't think that it rises to the level of removing the president. I think most of the motives are driven by that combination of principle and electoral self-interest and not fear of Donald Trump.
We got a note from Stephen who wonders, did anyone foresee the blowback effect that the impeachment trial would have on Joe Biden? Stephen writes, his ship is sinking along with the captains. So what are you seeing so far in any impact this may be having on Joe Biden's election bid?
Well, certainly the Republicans have waded into this territory in an effort to reframe this narrative as a question of corruption and linking that directly to Joe Biden's candidacy. Now, how successful they are, I'm not sure. What we know from the public opinion polling so far, there's really two things that strike me. One is there is a closely divided public when it comes to the question of whether the president should be removed. It's about 50-50, and it has stayed that way more or less since the impeachment process started back in October. Second, and this is quite interesting, Donald Trump's approval ratings have actually gone up during this process to a point where right now in the aggregate, looking at approval ratings sort of mixed together, he's the most popular he's been since shortly after he was elected. Now, we should be clear. When I say he's the most popular he's been, he's still not very popular. He's underwater. His approval ratings are about 47% approval, 52% disapproval. But nonetheless, it suggests that to the extent that the public is paying attention to this trial, and I'm not sure they are, it's not moving them one way or the other, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's been interesting. The question of whether or not people are paying attention to the trial is one thing, and it's sort of connected to how people are thinking about the presidential candidates and who they might vote for. But I keep hearing it framed as like, this is not an issue for Democratic voters. And I wonder what you think of that, Professor Dickinson, because I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. It may be that people are very – Democratic voters in particular have a vested interest in what happens in the impeachment trial, but it doesn't determine which candidate they might vote for in the primary. But it seems to keep getting framed as if that's not going to determine who they vote for, then they don't care about the impeachment process at all. Do you see those as two sort of separate issues, or are they too intertwined to break apart?
No, I think you're absolutely right, Jane. The problem for the argument that people aren't paying attention and don't care about impeachment is, in choosing your Democratic candidate, every Democratic presidential candidate believes the same thing, which is Donald Trump conducted an improper effort to influence the election by soliciting foreign aid. All of them are supporting his removal. So to say that it's not an issue that is going to determine who you vote for is not to say that Democratic voters don't care about this issue. It's just that it doesn't differentiate the candidates as well as their views on Medicare for all, for instance, health care insurance, or free college tuition. Those are the issues in which the voters see clear differences, and therefore those are the ones that may determine how they vote.
Professor Dickinson, I asked Senator Leahy what he thought on this, but I'm curious your perspective as well on this idea of what the burden of proof should be that senators use in determining whether they want to vote to convict or acquit President Trump of the charges. This was asked of the President's counsel and the House managers yesterday, and they had somewhat differing opinions, no surprise there. But it seems like it's sort of up to each senator, you know, what they want to use as their sort of bar or barrier. You know, what is it? Is it a reasonable proof? Is it proof beyond any doubt? How do you see it, and how you think senators are trying to figure that out?
Well, I thought that was a great question by you.
And, why, thank you.
it gets to the root of what the Senate is doing. They're often described as jurors sitting impassively, but they're not. Actually, we have 100 judges, and the difference is that in contrast to sort of a criminal trial where the judge will tell you what the law is and as a juror you apply it, in this case, we're not even sure what the law is. Each senator must come to their own determination on what constitutes an impeachable offense and what rises to the level of removal. And there really is very little guidance historically on this. We've only had 3 impeachments. Counting this one, and in the 2 previous ones, the presidents were not convicted. And so they're basically working this out on their own, on some combination of principle and electoral self-interest. But there's no clear guidelines in the Constitution on what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors. It is uncharted territory. And that's why the efforts on both sides to frame this, not just in terms of constitutional issues, but politically, is so crucial because it provides cover. It provides a cover to arrive at a conclusion, and then you could, working back from what you want to happen, you could determine what your criteria of removal is.
Speaking of cover, let's go to Kate, who's calling in from Jericho. Hi, Kate. What's your thought or question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just curious why we can't get to the root of everything and just have all the senators vote on a secret ballot, because that would take all of the pressure off them for their candidacies or anything that they're going for in November. I haven't heard that brought up, and so I'm just wondering why we can't pressure them to do that.
Kate, thanks for the call. Professor Dickinson, what about that idea of a secret ballot? So we'd get a vote. You wouldn't know how your senator voted necessarily, but maybe that would be a more honest way.
Well, it would be a more politically convenient way, but ask yourself, don't you want to know how your senator voted on one of the 3 times in which impeachment has come before the Senate? I just think this is an issue where senators have to step to the front and articulate and make a defense for their vote, not hide behind the cloak of anonymity. I think more voters would be upset about a secret ballot than would support it.
You know, we got a question, Matt, a few minutes ago from listener Mike, who called in and said, shouldn't maybe the sitting senators who are also running for president recuse themselves from this process because they are inherently biased because of the benefit it might give to them if the president were convicted? Similarly, along similar lines, you mentioned, you know, that you think they're doing their duty, or they say, this is my duty as a senator to sit in judgment in an impeachment trial. This is a very solemn burden or duty that I must bear as a sitting senator. But when we look at the senators who are running for president, why does that not extend to their other duties as a sitting senator who's running for president? And I don't actually know the voting records of Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren as well, but we know that Bernie Sanders has missed nearly every vote since he's been on the road campaigning. So where do they feel that responsibility to do their duty as a senator versus the importance of running for president and why that may be more important than votes on legislation?
Well, that's a great question. And it has come up On the campaign trail. Most notably, I remember a Tulsi Gabbard rally I attended in which the audience member asked her point blank, justify the fact that you have the worst voting record in the House because you're spending all your time on the campaign trail. And her response, I think, is one that a lot of presidential candidates would argue, which is this is perhaps the most important decision that as a country we are going to make, this presidential election. And it is imperative that anybody who seeks that office put forward the strongest possible case. And yes, that means the other aspects of their duties, their role as representative or senator, is going to slip. The difference, I think, they would say with the constitutional impeachment is this rises to a level that goes beyond sort of voting on legislation, as important as that is, or engaging in casework. The constitutional duty to sit in judgment of the president, I think in terms of priorities, probably takes precedent over anything else a senator might do.
So you think that that's a valid response? I mean, should there be maybe a movement to say you have to quit? You have to quit your job as a senator or as a representative if you want to run for president. If you want to do this and put your full effort into it, you can't do two jobs at once.
Some people do that. We've seen candidates who have decided that they should step down and not run for re-election. That's not happening in this cycle, but it's not unheard of. I think it's a valid question. But here's the answer I think they might give is as a voter, you can factor that into your decision. Let's assume that Amy Klobuchar loses out. Let's assume that Bernie Sanders does not get the nomination. He still has to be held accountable by the people. And certainly his opponent can say, if you reelect Senator Sanders, what's going to prevent him from running off and run for president? And in fact, this came up, as you'll recall, Jane, when Senator Sanders last ran for the reelection here. His opponent said, you are going to elect an absentee senator. And he was right. But the public did not seem to care, at least not in Vermont. So, yeah, I think it's a valid concern. And it's a concern that the voters must carry with them is when they're in the voting booth.
It would be interesting to see a Democratic challenger or another independent challenger to Bernie Sanders as opposed to a Republican challenger bringing up that question. Because, again, to that question of in the minds of the voters, is it that this is not an issue for them or is it that it is less of an issue in determining how they're going to actually vote, you know, whether or not they would like to see their senator sort of be in the seat for the vote? Because, you know, it's hard to say, like, what's the reason that you voted for this one person over the other?
And it's also the case that I think some Sanders supporters will say, if that's the price I need to pay, that Senator Sanders will not be fully carrying out his job as Senate. In order to see him as president of the United States, I think it's a trade-off worth making.
Professor Dickinson, you are very active on Twitter and very active in going to campaign events, going to New Hampshire, going in a few days, I believe, to Iowa in advance of the caucuses. I think you were at Mike Bloomberg's event in Burlington earlier this week. What's your purpose in actually going to all of these events and really sort of being present in the room as these candidates are making their case and as voters are trying to determine who they might want to vote or caucus for?
Well, there's a pedagogical purpose here, which is I teach elections, I teach American politics, and I think this benefits me as a teacher. It's also the case that you know I've done media stuff before, and if you remember, and I hope you don't, back in 2015 when Donald Trump came down the escalator, many individuals in the media asked me what he was going to do, and I said he would be out of the race in about 2 weeks. And look how that turned out.
But we still have you on the show. What are we doing having you on the program?
That may be your fault more than mine. But my point is after that, I realized I did not understand the source of his support. And I began going to his rallies. And only then did I get a view and talking to his supporters, seeing his message and how it resonated with them, that this guy had tapped into something that I was missing just based on media reports. And so I vowed I would not make that mistake again. And so in this current election cycle, it has been fascinating to see how the Democrats are framing this election and how the voters are reacting to it. And I will say sort of the preview if we want to discuss this, the what to me is the most interesting aspect of this election so far is the high degree of uncertainty. I mean, going into Iowa, where you're right, I'll be next weekend or this coming weekend, I think polls suggest 40% of Iowans do not know who they're going to support. This is unusual this late in the contest to have that much uncertainty.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting to see all of this. And we were talking earlier about what's the potential impact of this trial on Joe Biden, but, you know, also on these other senators who are running for president and also on the other candidates like Pete Buttigieg, for example, who might see an opening that may not otherwise have been there given the potential damage to the other candidates. So I imagine Iowa is going to be a pretty interesting place to be for the next couple of days.
Iowa is going to be fascinating for a couple of reasons. One is, if you recall Bernie Sanders in 2016, his strength was in caucus states. His weakness was in large primary states, particularly those with diverse population. So we're expecting Bernie Sanders to do quite well in Iowa. If he falls short of those expectations, that's a sign that his candidacy may not be as strong. So I'm going to be looking at that. The second thing is the dynamics of caucuses are fascinating. As you know, you do not get all the votes from the people who support you. If you fall short in a particular precinct of 15%, your supporters have to go to some other candidate. And that means somebody like Amy Klobuchar, who's polling at about 10 to 12%, may actually be a kingmaker. She may fall short of 15% in enough precincts so that her supporters – have to decide who they're going to back. So one of the interesting questions is who's the second choice among all these candidates? So there's a lot of uncertainty rooted in the dynamics of Iowa. And I think Iowa is going to begin to give us some answers about particularly winnowing the field as we head into New Hampshire.
Let's get one more call in here from Pete in St. Johnsbury. Hi, Pete. Go right ahead.
Hello. Just have a quick question for the professor. Given the state of partisan divide that we now have, I'm wondering if you see any way to reunify the country in any meaningful way.
So what about this, reunifying the country? I mean, certainly we are awfully divided right now. What do you think, Matt?
The issue of polarization is one that political scientists have felled a thousand trees debating, and I would make this distinction. Our choices are deeply polarized. By that I mean our members of Congress are deeply polarized on ideological and partisan lines. There's no doubt about that. Interestingly, surveys suggest the public is not so divided on issues like abortion or school choice. They're really centrist. But when they're faced with two ideologically distinct choices, it appears they're more divided than they are. What needs to change is not so much the convictions of the public. They all want to see us come together. They want to see a Congress that can get things done. It's the choices. And there we have to do another radio program. It touches on the role of primaries, the role of money, the role of social media. All of this is contributing to politics in which our choices are deeply polarized, even if the public is not.
Yeah, but it also seems like we have a hand in creating that. You mentioned the primary process. And if we, the voters, we, the American citizens, are the ones picking the more polarized candidates in the primary, you know, do we need to do some soul searching ourselves?
You're absolutely right. Ultimately, the buck stops with the voters. And there are moderate choices out there. The question is, are people passionate enough to show up in primaries to make that voice heard?
Well, I'll be curious to hear what you find in Iowa when you get back from there. And while you're tweeting, I'm sure, from there as well, we'll put your Twitter handle on our show page for the day so people can follow you if they want, if that's okay with you. Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. Matt, thank you very much for talking with us. And are you okay with your Twitter handle being shared?
I'm fine. The more the join in, the merrier. Let's have a discussion. Thank you, Jane.